So Thursday night, our nation attacked Syria after the world media showed photos from northwest Syria of adults and children stricken by poison gas attacks. This involvement of the United States in a foreign country is a continuation of a mission that started 100 years ago. Before April 2, 1917, the United States generally did not feel responsible for intervening in foreign conflicts. However, on that date, 100 years ago, a week ago, Woodrow Wilson proposed to Congress the most consequential shift in the history of American foreign policy. He addressed a joint session of Congress, the House and Senate, with the Supreme Court, the Cabinet, and diplomatic corps present as witnesses. In speaking to an isolationist nation, a nation that had long followed a policy of avoiding foreign entanglements, President Wilson declared that the United States must make the world safe for democracy. After his address, back then State of the Union addresses are given during the daytime, after his address, Wilson rode with his wife, Edith, and his private secretary in a car back to the White House. People lined the streets in Washington and applauded their president all the way home. Back in the White House, the president said, "Think of what it was they were applauding. My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems to applaud that." Wilson transformed a country with a minor military into a military power. By the time the war ended in November of 1918, more than 4 million men had served in the United States Army, including my own grandfather. My granddad survived his trip from Kentucky, where he worked in a coal mine, to France and back, only to die 3 months after he returned in the great flu epidemic. 100 years ago, William Howard Taft was vice president of the American Unitarian Association, having learned leadership skills by previously serving as president of the United States. When Wilson asked Congress to declare war on Germany in April of 1917, William Howard Taft was an enthusiastic supporter. But a few Unitarians did not support the entry into World War I. Reverend John Hames Holmes was the minister of a famous Unitarian church in New York City called the Church of the Messiah, later renamed Community Church. A committed social activist, Reverend Holmes helped found the American Civil Liberties Union. He helped found the National Association for the Advancement of Color People. Wilson spoke to Congress on a Monday, but the day before, anticipating Wilson's speech, John Hames Holmes spoke to his congregation, April 1, 1970. He said, "No nation is important enough. No human interest is precious enough to justify the wholesale destruction and murder which constitutes the science of war. So long as I am your minister, this pulpit will answer no military summons. Other pulpits may preach recruiting sermons. Mine will not. Other parish houses may be turned into drill halls and rifle ranges. Ours will not. Other clergy may pray to God for victory for our arms. I will not. In this church, if nowhere else in all America, the Germans will still be included in the family of God's children. No word of hate shall be spoken against them. No evil fate shall be desired upon them. In September, after the war had continued for several months with the United States involvement, Reverend Holmes attended a conference in Montreal, the General Conference of Unitarians, and he proposed a resolution in favor of reconciliation, a resolution of peace and social justice for the Unitarians to consider. President Taft denounced Reverend Holmes' proposal and instead introduced a pro-war resolution. It carried 236 for and 9 against. War crushes dissent. Unitarian churches throughout the country, including the Unitarian Church in Cincinnati, where President Taft was a member, dismissed their pacifist ministers. Now, 100 years later, the Unitarian Universalist Church is still not a pacifist religion. We are not like the Quakers or the Mennonites. Both former United States Secretary of Defense William Cohen and former Secretary of Defense William Perry are committed Unitarian Universalists. Many of you here today have served in the United States military, and I have officiated at a number of memorial services for Unitarian Universalists at Arlington National Cemetery. What is my own view? Are there just wars? In 1969, I applied to my draft board for status as a conscientious objector, what we called CO status, which doesn't stand for commanding officer, but conscientious objector. The law defines a conscientious objector as someone who, for religious reasons, opposes participation in all wars in any form. If I showed any ambivalence, the draft board would classify me as a selective objector and would turn me down and order me to appear for my physical at the induction center. If I wanted CO status, I needed to argue that no war is just. Trying to express this certainty in 1969, I wrote to my draft board that I was conscientiously opposed to participation in war in any form. In May of 1969, after an interview, the draft board granted me status as a conscientious objector. In the years since, I have looked hard for nonviolence as a way to resolve human conflict. In my adult life, I have observed our leaders trying to live up to Wilson's call to make the world safe for democracy. With the end of the Soviet Union in 1990, we took on as a nation the role of saviors of the entire world. In my personal archives on my computer, I have a sermon given in 1990 on why we should not use violence to save Kuwait from Iraq's invasion. I met with my congressman, I was in Illinois then, Congressman John Porter. Congressman Porter had held hearings in which a young lady had testified about the Iraqis taking babies out of incubators and leaving them to die and taking the incubators from Kuwait back to Iraq. I was unable to convince Congressman Porter that it was not good to invade Kuwait and restore the monarchy there. After the war was over, we found out that the young lady who had testified before him in Congress in his committee was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador and had been in San Francisco when she said she had been in Kuwait. And she had never seen the incubators or the babies being taken out. Wars are often based on lies. I gave a sermon in 1993 on how to help the starving people of Somalia without using military force. I invited my senator, Paul Simon, a man I greatly admired, to come to my church in Evanston, Illinois, and he came and talked about Somalia, but I was unable to convince him. A few months later, we had that terrible event occurring with the helicopters and Black Hawk Down and been made into a movie, and then we completely withdrew from Somalia. Moving to the Washington area, the son of the Secretary of Defense, William Perry, was a member of my congregation. He carried messages to his father about this pacifist minister who was opposed to a military invasion of Haiti. And in 1996, at my request, the Secretary of Defense came to my church and spoke to my congregation. Perhaps I was deceiving myself, but it appeared to me that a Unitarian Universalist Secretary of Defense was willing to look for nonviolent solutions to conflicts. I was glad he was in that role. In 1999, I gave what I thought was an excellent sermon on Kosovo and nonviolence, a sermon that no one but me today remembers. In 2001, I was interviewed on CNN about nonviolence and a way to respond to the September 11th attacks. In 2002, I gave a sermon against the invasion of Iraq, around the time that Donald Trump said he opposed it. I don't remember that, though. I do remember my words. What I have found over the years is that in every situation that I have studied, there are smart, politically wise people who are effectively working to solve conflicts nonviolently. And these people hunger. They hunger for the support of the United States government. In the early 1980s, I was fortunate to hear a lecture by a man named Gene Sharp. He was the author of an essay called Making the Abolition of War a Realistic Goal. Dr. Sharp is not someone who is a strong advocate of reading Gandhi or Martin Luther King and becoming a religious saint to end war. Instead, he's a very practical person. So he's written this most practical guide to nonviolent defense, the most practical one that has so far been written. Gene Sharp argues that to make the abolition of war a realistic goal, we should start with two premises. First, he said, all governments depend on the cooperation of people, the cooperation of people to supply the governments with their sources of power. And secondly, we human beings have an enormous capacity to be stubborn. to do what we want to do, and to refuse to do what others order us to do. In 1993, Dr. Sharp wrote an essay called From Dictatorship to Democracy. It's only 85 pages long. It has been translated into over 30 languages. It is widely available for free on the internet. And it has come to be the handbook for nonviolent revolution around the world. It was the guide that was used in the Arab Spring of 2011, From Dictatorship to Democracy. I thought of Dr. Sharp this week as I looked at the images of people dying from poison gas in Syria. Perhaps going to war against those who drop poison gas is an example of a just war. But because I believe that nonviolence is superior to violence, I have asked myself, what effective nonviolent actions can be taken in response to this terrible poison gas attack? Now, I haven't gotten a call yet, but if President Trump asks me for my advice, I would say to him, restore funding for the United Nations and for the State Department. He had serious cuts for both in his proposed budget. I would say to the president that diplomacy and world law provide an alternative to war. I would say, Mr. President, when world peace comes, it will come because the leaders of nations of the world agree to follow international laws. The Geneva Protocol is a treaty prohibiting the first use of chemical and biological weapons. It was signed at Geneva in 1925. The Chemical Weapons Convention outlawing the production, stockpiling, and use of chemical weapons was signed in 1993. When world peace comes, it will come because the leaders of nations of the world agree to follow and enforce such international laws. But how do we enforce them? The International Criminal Court is an international tribunal that sits in The Hague in the Netherlands. The International Criminal Court has the jurisdiction to prosecute individuals for crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. The court began functioning on July 1st, 2002. Currently, 124 nation states are members of the International Criminal Court. The United States is not a member. Well, how does this apply to the use of poison gas? A terrible crime has been committed. If President Trump were to ask for my advice, I would say the proper moral, the proper ethical response is an international police investigation. As international police identify the people who are guilty of the use of poison gas, they should do their best to take these suspects into custody. The International Criminal Court should try them. They are created to prosecute persons for genocide. Of course, this will not be easy. However, by joining with other nations in an international police force to track down these criminals, we will move the world a little closer to the dream of world peace through world law. Now, I'm not arguing for a return to the isolationism that we had in our country before the First World War. I am arguing that we can make the world safe for democracy with an international police force made up of people from all countries that are willing to participate, with the goal of arresting those responsible for such horrible attacks. This was Wilson's vision when he proposed the League of Nations. And it was the vision of the world leaders when they gathered in San Francisco to create the United Nations in 1945. In response to this terrible attack, I suggest our government encourage investigations, indictments, arrests, trials, and convictions by the International Criminal Court. I suggest the United States ratify the treaty establishing the court and accept the jurisdiction of the court, as 124 nations have already done. Of course, a civilized justice process takes time. Court cases can take many years. We have an emotional need to do something now, immediately, in response to this terrible attack. Well, there is something we can do instead of launching missiles. Thursday night, the president spoke of innocent civilians, of helpless men, women, and children, even beautiful babies. Like the president, my goal is to stop this killing and save as many lives as possible. If President Trump asks for my advice, I would suggest that he drop his travel ban, currently blocked by the courts, that halts all refugee entry from Syria. We cannot bring back the people who have died, but we can help those who are still alive. The most effective way to achieve this is to reopen our country to refugees from Syria and to encourage other countries to do likewise. A country of 23 million people, the civil war in Syria has already forced millions to leave. Turkey is the largest host country with nearly 3 million Syrian refugees. Lebanon is estimated to have more than 2 million refugees. Jordan has more than 1 million refugees. The United States should also accept some refugees. Still, most of the new refugees will likely settle in Turkey, Lebanon, or Jordan. These three countries will continue to need massive support to house and to feed these refugees. It will cost about $60 million to replace the 59 cruise missiles that the United States military rained on Syrian targets. Instead of replacing these missiles, we could use this $60 million to aid those escaping from the war. Helping refugees costs money, but it is far less expensive than sending American soldiers to try to end Syria's civil war. So I am not sympathetic with the president's desire to launch missiles. I do see his point of view. I feel the emotional satisfaction of blowing up the bad guys. When we do this, good and evil appear to be clear. Everything is easily focused. The politicians join ranks. Even Hillary Clinton praised the president. There's no need to think deeply or to worry about subtleties. The attacks are a grimly fascinating spectacle of modern computers, satellite guidance systems, and powerful missiles. If my life is humdrum here in Sarasota, boring and ordinary, then watching on television as the missiles are fired can offer me an exciting evening. However, when I try to think rationally instead of emotionally, I remember that vigilante justice most often leads to a cycle of attack and retaliation. We bomb them, they bomb us, in a cycle that dates back to the first Gulf War in 1991. In 2017, as an alternative to missiles, my hope is that the president will restore funding to the United Nations and the State Department. My hope is that the president will join with others in using the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute these crimes. My hope is that the president will welcome the refugees from Syria. These are constructive approaches to a terrible civil war. 100 years ago, this past week, Woodrow Wilson spoke to Congress, declaring that the United States must go to war to make the world safe for democracy. The day before, at the Unitarian Church in New York City, John Hames Holmes said to his congregation, "This war is wrong. I say to you that years hence, when the whole of this story has been told, it will be found that we have been tragically deceived and all our sacrifices have been made in vain." The next day, the president spoke to Congress, and then in the evening of that day, the Board of Trustees of the Unitarian Church in New York City, the Church of the Messiah, they held an executive session. They did not invite Reverend Holmes. Newspaper reporters had published stories about Reverend Holmes' sermon Monday morning, and then they gathered outside the church boardroom that evening. At the end of the meeting, a spokesperson for the board read a very short statement regarding Reverend Holmes' sermon. "The trustees of this church repudiate these ideas. This is our freedom as members of this congregation." But of Mr. Holmes' right to say what he did, there can be no question. This is his right as minister of this congregation.